Thank you, Jake. Good morning. Hi. Great to see you all here on a bright, sunny, and cool morning. My name is Tom Phillips. I'm the convener for today's service, and welcome to everybody to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. In case you didn't know, Unitarian Universalists have no required creed. We believe in the liberal ideal that each can find one's own path, whether it's working towards inner peace, particular social justice goals, or other religious destinations. And so I welcome you, whatever path brought you here, and I ask you to join us today with an open heart and open mind. Now, I want to call your attention to the announcements that are in the order of worship today. One thing to look forward to is the Christmas Eve service, which is coming up on Saturday, December 24th, at 7 o'clock in this room. And if you can come, please see if you can bring some cookies or other treats that we can share after the service. And then that's Saturday, and then to remember that we will have regular service here on Sunday the 25th.
Regular-ish.
It's Christmas, okay? That day is Christmas. There will not be regular RE, perhaps, but the children will be involved with the service here that day. Okay, the second announcement to pay attention to is we will have a congregational meeting right after this service to vote on a resolution regarding ending the use of Native American mascots in our community schools. The resolution is written there. The meeting should not take long, and I'm sure we'll remind you again. Okay, so today I've asked Nick to help with the chalice. No, wait a second. I forgot one thing. Could I hear an E-flat?
Come, whoever you are, wonder worshiper, lover of living, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come.
Sorry about that. Now, Nick will light the chalice, and I will say these words from Daniel Cantor. To love life is to notice the wonders that abound. And to notice the wonders that abound is to be grounded here and now. And to be grounded here and now is the beginning of finding love for this life today. Let us ground ourselves in this instant in the worship of all things good and right. So now, please stand for our opening hymn number 225 in the hardbound hymnal, O Come, Emmanuel.
Thank you.
So now is the time in our service when we share those significant joys and concerns we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing the heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. Please wait for the microphone so that all will hear you.
One of our members, Wayne Clark, had a heart attack and is in Stormont Vale Hospital in Topeka. He had bypass. He had five bypasses done. So he is in our hearts, and if you want to touch base with him, I know he'd appreciate it.
Hi, Jane Palletier. I don't have a cold. Morning voice. Mike Bonella, who most of you know, is having knee replacement surgery tomorrow morning, so keep Mike in your thoughts and good wishes, please.
This past week, it was a joy to see three of our children in the Eisenhower Middle School choir concert. Indigo Bellinger, Carrie Cave, and my daughter Helen played the flute. And they were amazing, good voices, and we hope you'll stick with that.
I have some good news. I heard from my son yesterday that his wife, Mary Champion, signed a contract with a clinic in Kansas City, and they will come back to Kansas this summer.
Hi, my name is Shannon Skelton, and my son, Kieran, had a concert this past weekend where he played the cello at Amanda Arnold, and we were very proud of him, and my daughter played the xylophone at her concert as well. But my daughter asked me to say something, that she's going to be getting a diabetes pump very soon. She's type 1 diabetic, so it's going to make things a lot easier, so we're very excited about that.
All right. Okay, well, we honor those joys and concerns both. One more.
Sure.
All right. No?
All right.
Okay. Well, still those spoken and unspoken. Now, special music. Yep. Okay.
Theme is about Jesus in Christmas, appropriately enough. Our first piece is very old in terms of the liturgy. It's Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy on us. Very simple, but a new version of it. The second one is a spiritual that is at least 200 years old, an arrangement by a great African-American composer, arranger, Harry T. Burley, that's 100 years old. So, but that's in order.
Thank you.
Okay, this is the time for Story of All Ages, and children and any others who'd like to join, please join me by the piano. Good turnout. Awesome. Okay, so there is a big holiday coming up a week from today, next Sunday, and the name of that holiday is?
Hanukkah.
That's one of them. There's something like 24 different holidays. Christmas. New Year's coming up, too. The one I'm going to talk about is Christmas, but not actually what is Christmas supposed to symbolize. What's it a historical sort of thing about? Jake. Christmas Day, sort of near a barn. Go ahead. Jesus was born. Where was he born? You have no idea? Where was he born?
In a manger outside of a city. I forgot the name of it.
What's a manger?
It's a little barn.
Okay, too much information. Anyway. Actually, today, a week before Christmas, so we're not going to talk about the baby being born. You know, there's some miracles and stuff associated there. I want to just talk about Jesus, the man, because actually what he did supposedly was what he did as an adult, okay? So I'm going to tell this story written by Sophia Lyons-Foss, and it's called The Very Short Rule, and it's pretty much about Jesus being a teacher and meeting with people and people listening to what he had to say. So, when Jesus came into a town, someone who knew him was sure to pass the word around. A plan would be worked out for him to be at a certain place when evening came and the day's work was done, okay, when people were done working. And the men and the women who had to work during the day could then gather and listen to what Jesus had to say that evening. Sometimes they'd find him in the house of a friend, and the number of people who would come might fill the whole house and the street outside, too. Other times they'd follow Jesus to the lake. He and some of the fishermen friends would step into a boat. They would anchor the boat near the shore, and then the people would sit on the rocks and grass nearby, and Jesus would stand up in the boat and talk to everybody. So, I mean, if we pretend that this is the shoreline, Wait a second. And I'm in the water, and you're the people listening, and I'm Jesus, okay? But I'm just going to be the reader here. Okay, but to the right, yeah. Sorry, everybody. Okay, sometimes there were men and women who listened to Jesus who were very much discouraged, okay? They were sad. Some of them were poor. They did not get enough to eat. Some had sick children to take care of at home. Some were old and crippled and always in pain. Some felt that nobody cared for them. They were always given the hardest jobs at work to do, and they were always being scolded by their boss because they did not do the job well enough. These people went regularly once a week to the synagogue on the Sabbath. What is a synagogue? You knew what Hanukkah was.
It's sort of like a Jewish version of a church.
Yeah, Jewish version of a church. How about Sabbath? Yeah? Jewish day of rest, right. Right. So we're Sunday is the traditional day of rest for us as Unitarians, and do you know when the Sabbath begins for Jewish people? Yeah, Friday night and it goes till Saturday night. Okay. It's a lot of fun on Saturday night sometimes. So anyway, they would go to the synagogue and hear all the stuff they had to do, all these rules and such. They heard the Bible read to them, but they could not remember all that they heard. So they did not do all that they were told they ought to do. They knew they were not praying as often as they were told to pray, but it was so hard to remember the words to say. They knew they were not giving as much money as they were told to give to the synagogue, but they had so little money to live on, how could they give more to the synagogue? They admitted that they did not work on the Sabbath, while the teachers said they should never do any work at all on that day. They admitted they did some work on the Sabbath, but the rule was no work on the Sabbath. But the hours in the week were not long enough to get everything done they had to do to keep their children from starving, so they did work on the Sabbath. Often they'd go home after listening to Jesus, and they would remember just one or two little stories or one short sentence that Jesus had said. But that little bit they remembered a long, long time because somehow they liked to remember it. Such people as these were naturally discouraged. You know, they'd be bummed out. They felt all the time that their teachers were not pleased with them. If their teachers were not pleased, then probably God was not pleased either. This thought made them feel even more discouraged. So one day, as Jesus was sitting in a boat and the people were squatting on the rocks on the shore and listening to him, one of these discouraged men asked a question. "I am a shepherd," he said. Who knows what a shepherd is? Something with sheep, right? He herds sheep, hence shepherd, yeah. And so I'm a shepherd, and I have to spend long hours in the open fields with my sheep. And when eating times come, I've got my lunch with me, but I can't always find a stream or a place where I can wash my hands before I eat. And it's a rule, is it not, that a man should always wash his hands before eating? Do you think, Jesus, that I am a bad man because I have to eat my lunch without washing my hands? Certainly not, said Jesus with a smile. You are not a bad man simply because you eat without washing your hands when you're in the fields and can't do so. Unwashed hands cannot make a person bad anyway. Goodness and badness are inside of you, not in your skin. When a woman spoke up and asked another question, "There are many of us here, Jesus, who have never learned to read. We have not gone to school. We have not been able to study the laws in the Bible. We can't remember all the laws the preachers in the synagogue tell us about. There seem to be hundreds of laws the preachers say we must follow if we want to please God, but we simply cannot remember them all. Do you think, Jesus, that we are bad because we can't remember all the laws? Our other teachers seem to think that we're no good just because we don't know very much." Then Jesus tried to encourage these people. He would say, "For many years, our teachers have been adding more and more laws to the ones that are already in the Bible. They've been meant to help us, but they're really done to make a living of a good life so hard that none of us can be counted as being good," right? If you don't follow those laws, you're not good. "I say to you, friends, that being good is not just obeying a large number of rules. You could obey every single one of the rules the teachers have made and still not be really good. Whether one is good or not depends on how one feels inside one's heart. Do you feel hateful or loving towards others? Do you feel angry or patient with the person who hurts you? Those are the things that count. "That kind of talk sounds good, Jesus," said a man who'd been busy all day hauling stones for building a road. "But I wish you would tell us in just one sentence what is the most important so that we can't forget." Jesus smiled at this and he said, "Your wish reminds me of what someone once told in a story to Hillel, the great teacher of ours whom you've all heard about. The story is told of how a student one day said pretty much the same thing to Hillel. Tell me, Rabbi, what all the laws put together mean, and tell me so simply that I can hear it all while I'm standing on one foot." In other words, it needs to be a short enough sentence that he could do it while standing on one foot. Can anyone say a simple sentence standing on one foot? You want to try that? What sentence will you say? Let's see. Peter picked a peck of... No, I don't know. Merry Christmas to... Wow. Okay. Okay. So, and if we have balance, we can do that. So, very good. At this, everyone laughed, right? Hillel gave the student a very good answer and a very short one. This is to say on one foot. Hillel said, "Never do anyone else the kind of thing that is hateful to you. This is all the laws put together. All the rest is just an explanation of that one short rule." Then Jesus added his own thought. "I would say this rule in just a little different way, and I would say it this way. Do those things to others that you would like to have others do to you. Do those things to others that you would like to have others do to you." "That's a good rule," said the workman who had asked the question. "I could have stood on one foot easily while you said that." "Try the rule," said Jesus. It doesn't take long to say it, but it may take a long time to learn to follow it." Okay, let's see if we can memorize that. The words aren't the way I'd write a sentence all the time. Do those things to others. Mm-hmm. That you would like to have others do to you. You would like to have others do to you. So all together now. Do those things to others that you would like to have others do to you. Pretty simple. "Try the rule," said Jesus. "It doesn't take long to say, as he said, but it may take a long time to learn to follow it." When his talk was over, the people got up from the ground and walked along the shore to their homes. Some of them seemed very much relieved. Jesus had given them something they could understand and something they could not forget. Do those things to others that you would like to have others do to you. It was a very short rule, but one that is still remembered after nearly 2,000 years back when Jesus lived. We call it our golden rule. Anybody heard of the golden rule before? Yeah? Absolutely. It's not a bad one. And I'm a lot older than you guys, and whenever I feel like I'm getting angry, I got to remember that, you know? You got to think. So I'm still working on it. And practice makes perfect. So, okay, we'll go off to RE now. So now is the time for our offering. The offering is a sign and symbol of our uniting together. Because we offer to this fellowship our time, treasure, and talent, we are able to do more together than we could ever do alone. In that spirit, we now receive our offering. Beautiful, Matthew. Okay, so as a lead in to Reverend Johnstone's reflection today, I want to read. We have a song also. We have a hymn. I'm anxious, right? Sorry. All right, so this is our hymn for the month. And please join as you are able. Santa, join as you are able. Hymn 55. So now, as a lead into Reverend Johnstone's reflection, I'm going to read a short Christmas sermon written by Peter Sampson. Again, the life of Jesus. One of the real miracles of Christmas is that the man Jesus has survived what centuries have done to his memory, and that the human spirit of the man is alive among us, undimmed by ages of distortion and denial. This life and teachings of Jesus were obscured as people told themselves that certain doctrines about the manner of his birth and the meaning of his death were of the essence of religion. A faith he never knew and a church he never envisioned were erected around his name and enforced by the prestige of his memory with a narrow dogma that was no part of his outlook on life. Not as a God who once visited the earth do we revere the young Jew who made so profound and lasting an impression upon the flowing centuries since his time. Not as a disembodied divinity do we value his memory, but as a man who was gifted beyond the usual run of people sensing the deepest realities of our life. Jesus saw the past, the circumstances, and the limiting conditions that cramped the understanding of most people, and he followed the light of his own integrity, even to the death that his world made inevitable. The real immortality of Jesus was to live as a creative memory in the hearts and imaginations of millions of people to whose conditions and needs he spoke the few scattered words we have as his last monument. This is the Jesus who legend says was born on Christmas Day, a child of the earth, born of the love and need of a man and woman for each other, reared as a child among children, a man who believed in the Hebrew faith of his ancestors and his time, and whose sense of life led him to stress unforgettably the humane insights of that faith. Yes, a man whose intense, generous humanity has survived the human creeds, crusades, violence, and insipid sentimentalities that have been created in his name. This is the real Christmas we celebrate, the birth and triumph of a prophet. This is the human miracle that undergirds the customs we freely delight in.
I'm in the camp that says we can't ignore Jesus at Christmas. I know that not all you use are on that page. For many, the less said about Jesus, the better, especially about Christ. Do you know the old joke? How are Unitarians like vampires? They both come from Transylvania and cringe at the sight of crosses. Now, some of the earliest Unitarians, indeed, were from Transylvania. And there are still Unitarian churches there. It's a real place. And that's Reformation history that we can talk about some other time. As for the cross cringe, it's not part of our religious practice. It is personal responses based on personal histories. In all seriousness, many UUs have some sort of negative history with some brand of Christianity. Some have been sorely wounded by being told at an early age that they were going to hell, or singled out for their sexuality or other characteristics, and others simply never got it. Whatever it was that Christians found so helpful in their religion, continually they asked questions that no one could or would answer well. Other UUs, though, still find great meaning in Christianity, and particularly in the life and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. In fact, the UU Christian Fellowship, a group of non-creedal UU followers of Jesus, has had a bit of a revival in the last 20 years, emerging from a rather somber association preserving historical Unitarian views of Jesus to a vital community of spiritually engaged people who pray, baptize, and worship while committed to UU skepticism, openness, and inclusivity. Somehow, Jesus persists in the human imagination, even for UUs. Or as Peter Sampson said, Jesus survived what centuries have done to his memory. And that's worth looking at. Early Unitarians in this country included William Ellerly Channing, often called the founder of Unitarianism here, who, escaping Calvinism, questioned the doctrine of the Trinity. He saw the church as manufacturing creedal tests that Jesus himself would have disapproved of. Rather, Channing saw Jesus as God's representative on earth, his son, yes, but not God. Instead, a perfect man. Unlike later Unitarians, Channing actually believed that Jesus did miracles and had greater than human authority. But not much later than that, Theodore Parker, committed abolitionist preacher and so radical in his theology that even other Unitarians shunned him, concluded that the truths that Jesus taught did not rest on his authority. Rather, Jesus' teachings no more depended on his authority than Archimedes' truth rested on his authority. The truth of the claims that were made were what made Jesus a great man, not the other way around. It was not that Jesus said them that made them true. Now, this may not sound radical to 21st century postmodernists, but it did to mid-19th century Christians. Yet even theologically conservative Unitarians like Henry Whitney Bellows, an important figure in organizing Unitarianism, agreed that the life and character, and these are his words, the life and character of Christ is the criticism and correction of what his disciples have said about him. So that background of 19th century Unitarianism takes me close to my thinking here about the presence of Jesus. What would make a person so compelling that when he died, people would still believe he lived on? Now, these aren't unimaginable claims. People in mourning often experience the presence of their dead loved one. People have even made reports of Elvis living long after he died. I've often thought that an exploration of the persistence of the living Elvis would make a compelling Easter sermon, but I have not yet dared to write it. But to so capture the collective imagination that a whole religion emerges after one's death, The credit for that goes only to a few people through the millennia: Lao Tzu, Buddha, Muhammad, Moses, Baha'u'llah, Jesus. Each of these figures has a compelling story, or it would not have persisted through the centuries as the foundation of a religion. So stripping aside as best we can the accretions of centuries, what is it about the presence of Jesus that made his influence endure? We follow in imminent footsteps in trying to complete this task. In 1820, Thomas Jefferson, who declared himself to be a Unitarian, though no such congregations existed in Virginia in his day, he went through the Gospels with scissors, cutting out the parts he found questionable and compiling what he called the Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Today it's called the Jefferson Bible. His version of the Christmas story boils down to Mary and Joseph travel to Bethlehem, where Jesus is born. That's it. No angels, no shepherds, no magi, not even any dreams or other messages from God. No sign that Jesus is Son of God. Jefferson leaves plenty of room in his collection for the parables, the Sermon on the Mount, and other teachings, but omits all miracles, healings, anything Jefferson thought unreasonable. In his own way, Jefferson's work belongs to the so-called search or quest for the historical Jesus, which had multiple iterations, beginning with Enlightenment approaches to reading historical texts in new, more scholarly ways, situated in historical context and analyzing the literary cues. And the efforts continue. The latter part of the 20th century brought us the Jesus Seminar. Anybody heard of the Jesus Seminar? Okay, yeah. A group of about 200 scholars called Fellows by Robert Funk, who tried to determine what words and acts Jesus most likely actually said and did. And they voted with beads, red and pink and gray and black beads, to indicate how historical they believed a particular saying or action to be. Now, that sounds kind of cheesy, voting with colored beads, but it was recognized scholars voting, people like Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan, Walter Wink, and John Shelby Spong. The result is a stripped-down version of the Gospels, the Gospel of Jesus, according to the Jesus Seminar, not unlike Jefferson's Bible, but by consensus of credentialed experts in religion and including references to other parts of the New Testament and to non-canonical works like the Gospel of Thomas. Now, here's their Christmas story. Jesus was a descendant of Abraham. Jesus' parents were named Joseph and Mary. Jesus was born when Herod was king. 8 days later, when the time came to circumcise him, they gave him the name Jesus. Okay, that's as stripped down as Jefferson's version. The Jesus Seminar had better developed arguments and more people making them, and they even retain in their gospel some of Jesus' miracles and post-resurrection appearances. I think that one of the most helpful recent innovations to understanding who Jesus was comes through scholarship by Jews, especially Amy Jill Levine, who is New Testament professor at Vanderbilt. And the Jews who are studying Jesus and the New Testament look at Jesus as inside the Jewish tradition rather than simply as a disruptor of that tradition, which Christians have often done. They often want to say how Jesus was different from Jews. Levine sees the continuity with the Hebrew traditions and helps to place Jesus in a cultural and historic context. So there's been lots of work through the centuries on who was Jesus. And this morning I want to take a particular perspective, and that's based on our theme for this month, presence. What was there about the presence of Jesus that caught people's attention in the first century and kept it through subsequent history? Well, first, let's look at the concept of presence. Other than being one of those gauzy spiritual words that's hard to pin down, what the heck is it? I looked to the definition by Amy Cuddy, Harvard Business School professor and social psychologist. She does not indulge in the esoterics of the spirit world, but stays close to earth in her explorations. After all, she is a business school professor. She says, we recognize presence most easily in its absence. That is, when we know that we are not present, or we sense that someone with us is not really present. And Cuddy, particularly in her studies of entrepreneurs and investors, has pushed back the gauzy curtains and poked around through scientific studies to identify some of the characteristics that go with presence. Confidence, comfort, passion, and enthusiasm. She claims that when people try to fake these qualities, others can tell something is wrong. Presence, she says, boils down to the state of being attuned to and able to comfortably express our true thoughts, feelings, values, and potential. A lot of times we're in situations where we're not sure it's safe to share ourselves in that way. But presence is the quality that allows us to do that. It seems to have a lot to do with sincerity and personal power, the ability to be ourselves, making the connections with others so unmistakably that we also, our connection with ourselves so unmistakably that we can also connect with others with authenticity and genuineness. And this kind of presence allows us to hold on to a sense of calm when panic and anxiety might be natural responses. Another word that comes to mind for me in this talk of presence is one from psychology, self-differentiation. That is, not relying on external circumstances or relationships for one's sense of worth. When self-differentiated, you can develop your own sense of self, beliefs, and values without simply taking on what your family has given you or even reacting against theirs. The self-differentiated person does not easily take on anxiety and worries of other people or feel that they have to follow the crowd. So how does this quality of presence, as summarized by Cuddy and supplemented by me, figure in what we know of Jesus? From an early age, Jesus showed a willingness to make his own decisions. The one gospel story from his childhood tells of him going with his family to the temple in Jerusalem, but staying behind to learn from the priests and teachers, declaring to his anxious, searching parents when they finally find him, "Did you not know I would be in my Father's house?" Jesus began his ministry not plunging in with declarations and assertions, but first with a retreat into the wilderness where he wrestled his own demons. He was not afraid to be associated with and even baptized by his relative, the wild man John, who preached in the wilderness and was ultimately murdered for his rabble-rousing. Throughout his 3 years of teaching, Jesus didn't mind expressing opinions that were unlike those of other people, differentiating himself where he saw things uniquely. In his day, various groups existed among Jews with conflicting ideas and impulses. Zealots who sought a military overthrow of the conquering Romans. Pharisees who sought adherence to the law. Essenes who escaped hermit-like into spiritual communities set apart from civilization. And others. Jesus had a healthy understanding of his Jewish tradition, but could see where it was helpful and where some people might draw the lines too harshly. For example, when admonished for letting his disciples violate Sabbath laws, he answered, "The Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath." Over and over through the Gospels, Pharisees and others question Jesus, sparking answers that cleverly thread a needle, embracing Jewish tradition and adding a twist to it. Should we pay taxes, they ask. Whose picture's on the coin, he answers. When told Caesar, he says, render to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God what's God's. A deceptively simple answer, not endorsing rebellion against Rome, nor embracing a Roman approach to religion. In casting the moneylenders from the temple, Jesus refuses to accept common practices that he feels challenge sacred space. If he did not care about the Jewish religion, he would not have been concerned about those attempting to make a profit from it. His parables raise as many questions as they answer. Even when he explains them, the teachings are not easy, and draw from images and practices of his day, focusing on agriculture, animal husbandry, fishing, the ways of life that existed around him. He knew how to speak to people of his time, place, and culture, even as he delivered a message that might have been hard to interpret. The way he treated others stood out. And that's a really important place for presence. Despite cultural traditions, he spoke with and taught women as well as men, Samaritans as well as Jews. The stories of his one-to-one interactions show him listening and concerned, but not losing himself in others, still expressing his own views and values. Famously, he shared table fellowship with tax collectors and prostitutes. So William Ellery Channing, the 19th century Unitarian, said that Jesus saw God in other people. He didn't worry about who he was associating with because he knew that judgments of them did not reflect on him. His identity was stronger than that. Channing also wrote that, and here are his words, remarkable as was the character of Jesus, it was distinguished by nothing more than calmness and self-possession. How calm was his piety. He never lost the possession of himself in his sympathy with others, was never hurried into the impatient and rash enterprises of an enthusiastic philanthropy, but did good with tranquility and constancy, which mark the providence of God. Jesus' calm comes through in lots of different stories in many places where others panic. Certainly in the build-up to the crucifixion, he maintained a sense of calm, but also in calming the storm, the tempest, in keeping his head when thousands gather and there's no food, and when he's questioned impertinently. All these occasions point to a centered presence. Nothing captures me as much, though, as his teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. Not really a single sermon, but a collection of sayings. This litany offers some of the greatest spiritual challenges that Jesus has to offer. And if he put these things into practice, I can see where he developed the kind of presence that Cuddy talks about. He recites how the law has called people not to kill or commit adultery, but he warns about the emotional responses that precede those actions. In Buddhist terms, he was concerned not only with right action, avoiding killing and sleeping around, but also with right thought. I don't think Jesus was suggesting that we should try not to have feelings, but to be aware of where that anger, where that lust could lead you if you weren't careful, to find ways to release them so they do not control you. He gives constructive advice about reconciling with other people before trying to make offerings to God. He dares to counsel nonviolence in an occupied land, saying, "Do not resist an evildoer." Courageous advice that is spoken to pacifists through the ages, his famous turn the other cheek. He asks his followers not to judge others, but to attend to their own shortcomings. He cautions against worry, encouraging reflection on nature. Consider the lilies of the field. He issues the golden rule that Tom spoke of with the children. He warns about false prophets. These three short chapters in Matthew contain spiritual advice worthy of years of contemplation and study. I've spent a lot of time with them and never regretted any of it. If we can be clear enough in ourselves to release our judgments of others, then we can be present to them. If we can let go of anxieties and trust, then we can present ourselves as we really are, without distraction by our human foibles. If we can draw from tradition without being bogged down by it, we can carve our own path, embrace our own beliefs, and be strong enough in that that we do not have to be defensive or reactive with others who differ from us. In short, if we can follow the teachings of Jesus, we can learn presence. Henry Whitney Bellows, mid-19th century organizer of Unitarians and of good causes in general, claimed Jesus not as God, but as a model to emulate. He centered on the heart of Jesus rather than theological specifics. And contemporary UU minister and my friend Ron Robinson speaks of his UU Christianity this way: to really follow in the spirit of Jesus means to be in right relationship with those who are different from me, to find mutual healing and transformation in such relationships. So, Jesus can continue to be relevant. His presence, his ability to differentiate his teachings, to be fully himself even when challenged, echo through the ages and invite consideration even by skeptics and doubters. So at this time, I'd invite comments, question, discussion about the reflection I've shared. And more than that, though, I'd be interested in hearing how the teachings or person of Jesus have touched you. So, if you have something to say, Mark will bring you the mic.
Christopher Renner. When I was leaving the Catholic Church, one of the quotes that has stuck with me all through my life is that you got to separate the church from God. And as I read other great philosophers like Gandhi in particular and Jay Krishnamurti, trying to find a new center of philosophy for my life, you know, it was interesting to go back and read the Gospels mm-hmm. from a philosophical point of view rather than a religious point of view, because you find that idea, do unto others as others would have, as you want others to do to you, that keeps getting repeated, regardless of the world religion. So maybe Jesus, through his studies, had come into contact with some of the writings of Buddhism, who knows, or the Bhagavad Gita, but these ideas seem to be universal within religion. And so that's the one thing I can take away. The problem is the institution that's mm-hmm. been built around this concept of a person, and that is not a good thing.
Kristen Corwin, a couple thoughts. Last night I watched a sign language video about Christmas time by a wonderful woman, Rachel Coleman, and she taught the sign for Jesus, which is to touch the centers of the hands. And I thought, wow, if you talk about Jesus in sign language, you just can't get away from his death every mm-hmm. time you teach it, even to a small mm-hmm. child. Mm-hmm. And because it's where the marks on the hands formed, you touch the center of the palm. And so last night, as my son was falling asleep, we talked about religion and why don't we celebrate Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. And he continued to ask about Jesus, and he says, "Mom, I believe the opposite of you. I think he's real and he's God and he came back to life." And I said, "Well, why do you think that?" And he said, "Because otherwise we wouldn't have Christmas." And I said, "Go to sleep. We'll talk tomorrow." So I'm looking for advice, parenting and otherwise. Thank you.
Christmas is a good thing.
About the what presence means, I'm reminded of a couple of lines in a song that a friend of mine wrote. When you look across the table, see acceptance in their eyes, and you share a meal together, and you speak without disguise. That speaking without disguise embodies for me the notions of being present that you were talking about. And oddly enough, that independence of others' opinions gets is part of speaking without disguise. You're not you're not worried about what does the other person think.
Right.
Which reminds me of the title of a wonderful collection of true stories called "What Do You Care What Other People Think?" this is the stories about a physicist, Richard Feynman, who was notably independent of what other people thought, much as you describe Jesus, which would probably shock Feynman.
A friend of mine used to say, "What you think of me is none of my business."
When I was growing up, especially as a teenager, the teachings of Jesus were really important to me in my life. But as I'm sitting here, was listening to you, the thought that kind of came forth for the first time was that the ultimate respect that we could pay to him and his teachings is to quit picking apart his birth, his life, take those thoughts that he taught as our own and move on and let him be.
Gene Severs. One of my favorite singer-songwriters is John Prine, and he has a farcical song about the 18 missing years of Jesus' life, and you know he does all this crazy stuff. But even in farce, I think there's a bit of truth in the line, "Buddha wasn't a Christian, but Jesus would have made a good Buddhist."
Indeed. Well, if there are no... Oh.
Les Slotsky. I just wanted to say, just the other day, I was thinking exactly of the core concept that you asked about, which is, what is it that these people historically did, what about them, that led so many other people for so long to remember them and think about them, and there's got to be something really important there, and the example of the golden rule passing down through so many religions. Yeah, and, but I think, yeah, I really got a lot out of your sermon. Thanks.
And if there's nothing more, then let me share some words from Bruce Clary. "Give us a decent Christ this Christmas. Give us the one who is neither a stranger to his world or ours, the genuine one. Give us the Christ who is the child of divinity in us and all, through whom all history speaks, through whom all the present is made joyful, and through whom all the future is a promise. Give us the Christ child, or give us the Christ Christ wanted us to know, the one who said that the kingdom of God is within us and that we are all children of the Most High. Give us a decent Christ this Christmas, not the cheap imitation we deify, not the foggy myth we try to demythologize, but the real and simple flesh and blood Christ who was born, who lived, who suffered, and sacrificed for the sake of love and peace and goodwill. Our closing hymn is number 276, O Young and Fearless Prophet. Of Sidney Wilde Nugent, may we now go into the world of the unknown confident that we carry within us the renewed light of love, peace, and joy, our own creativity and growth. As we move through life to the rhythms of the earth and sky, may we find comfort in the knowledge that indeed the spirit of our own divine child is born in us today. So be it. I would invite those who are